Okay, I'm so glad you all came back. That's just great. Okay, did anyone go through the homework experiences? Did you do it? Did you do the cards and the mitzvah notes? No, not the mitzvah notes. It's worthwhile. I'm telling you, it's worthwhile for you to try it. How were the class experience? Was it like helpful? Was it fun? Is it?
I like
things.
I like things. I actually think everything you have, you just start talking about things that you wouldn't normally talk about.
Excellent. Did anyone do the finite enumeration thing with coming up with a couple of words and adjectives? Yeah. How was that experience? Yeah.
How do you remember the things?
So in my house, what's become a running joke is when something goes on, I'll say, that's number 37. Let's move on to the book. What's that? What is that? What is it? But those exercises are excellent. And the purpose of them, again, just as we've done last week, is really to create a certain atmosphere in the home. And it really does create that atmosphere of developing a friendship. All of you obviously have families already, and you know the pressures on time and work and family, all that goes on. And these activities are really geared towards those things, and they're worth continuing and pulling out every once in a while, going out to a Starbucks on a Saturday night and just taking the cards with you or keeping them in the glove compartment or something that I had suggested before. I heard that from someone else or in the books or the conferences. It's a great thing to have in the car on these long trips, those of you who go away to New York or elsewhere for winter break or summers. And what should we talk about? That's the worst question. What should we talk about? Talk to me. What should we talk about? Pull out the cards, you know, and you have all of these great open-ended questions that lead to real, just fun stuff. And sometimes we just need that stimulus to keep things going. I had one other question. Was there any other thing we're supposed to be working on? No. Okay. All right, so I wanted to do tonight two things. One is finish up that first idea of friendship, one more concept, one more idea, which is really my favorite of all of them. Then we'll move into the second phase of the program. Oh, I know what it was. How was Motzei Shabbos after our introvert-extrovert thing, in which 7 out of the 9 of us are totally different? Did that change anyone's approach to see the plan? That was sort of... but it's just worth noting, that was one of...
We found that you don't feel like we're all one or the other. Did you find that?
Some weeks it's...
I definitely get energy from being with people, but on the other hand, when I'm tired, I'd like to be alone, you know?
So, and that's true. You know, some people, even when they're tired, want to be with other people to get... That's how they wake themselves up, and it's always... I love, just once I came across that idea, being able to put into words the feeling that either I have or that, you know, my wife has, just being able to navigate life with that. Okay, let's move on to the next. Officially, it's level 3 in the house if you're following in the book, which is fine if you are, if you're not. The topic, the words that Gottman uses for this next thing is what he calls bidding, to make a bid. This is my personal favorite concept. And the basic idea is turning towards each other as opposed to turning away from each other. And the way that I want to go through this is combining from a bunch of different things that I've seen over the years, starting with the concept of an emotional bank account. I'm sure many of you have heard that phrase. It's used by many, many psychologists, marriage therapists, people who write books on these topics will use that phrase of an emotional bank account, which basically means is in every relationship, we have a certain reservoir of credits, if you will. As opposed to making deposits of money in the bank, we deposit credits, good things that we've done for each other, things that we've helped out or in any way been available to our spouse, and we sort of build up credit, and sometimes we have to make withdrawals when we do things wrong, and sometimes we put money in. It's a whole system of that. I like to use, again, a little bit. Yeah, same concept. That's
Chapman.
Yeah. That's quite nice. I'm sure we'll hear later when he was always prompt and when he was always late, and we'll get in. You left the baby at home today. Yeah. Oh, I wish that was a joke. Too often that actually. Yeah. So whatever phraseology you want to use, a love tank or an emotional bank account in which there is a give and take between a spouse in terms of deposits and withdrawals. I like the concept of those of you who like to invest in anything, whether that's the market or in real estate. Everybody who makes investments knows you're going to lose sometimes. There's no question about that. Some investments go bad. The trick is to have enough winners to cover your losers. That's just the way that it goes. And relationships are the same. Anyone of us or out there who thinks that we're not going to make a mistake, we're not going to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, or not say the right thing when we were supposed to have said the right thing, or any one of those combinations, that's ridiculous. We know that. It takes about, 7 to 8 minutes of marriage to learn that you're going to make mistakes. There's no way around that. So the trick is, and whatever, imagery you want to create, building up enough of a reservoir of credit, so to speak, that when you have those withdrawals, you make those mistakes, it doesn't affect everything because you could easily just eat the loss and you're still in on good terms. An example of this, by the way, where you're holding in terms of making jokes. Those of us who have either a dry sense of humor or a sarcastic sense of humor. So whether or not you'll risk telling a joke, not but like sort of making fun of a person, and in spouses make very often like to poke fun at each other in a fun kind of way. It's always a risk when you do that it won't go over well. How willing you are to take that risk will often depend, assuming you're in a rational thinking mode, will depend on where your status is. If you're doing really well, the relationship is great, things are going fine, you compliment each other regularly, you both know that you love each other, you'll take that risk because, right, even if you mess up and it doesn't hit its mark or it doesn't come out right, you're fine because everybody knows, that I was joking, that I didn't really, if it's closer to neutral, if it's like bordering where you don't really have, you'll never go there because it's not worth it. It's not worth the risk because if it doesn't hit its mark and it's not funny, like, you're in trouble. And this really doesn't apply so much in our marriages, although it does in a second I'll get to it, but in our just relationships with other people, you'll know who you'll make jokes with and who you won't. You know which family members, which brother-in-law, which sister-in-law, which mother-in-law, don't even bother. It's just not going to be funny. It's going to be taken the wrong way. It's not worth it because you don't have that relationship where you're so far in the black of good place, being in a good place, it's not worth it. In a marriage, it happens when things are a little bit tense. You stay away from those things. As well, also, I love the joke example. You have more leeway to make those jokes because the spouse receiving it knows how to take it. I don't have to say it perfectly when my marriage is going well. I can be off on the delivery, and she still knows that I'm joking. Because it's so obvious our relationship is in a place, of course I'm joking when I say that. Maybe my delivery was off and I'm having a bad day, but clearly I didn't mean it seriously. If you're not in that place, so then when the delivery is off, it's actually perceived as an insult because of where you're holding. The way that we take in information is based on where we're at in that place, and we actually perceive things that way. Okay. Years ago, I read somewhere in a parenting book that our interactions between ourselves and our children should be 80% positive and 20%, I don't say negative, but some way critical or constructive or not non-positive. The ratio of our interactions has to be 80 positive, 20 negative. 8 to 10, 4 to 1 ratio. And I'm sure in other books that you read, you could hear Gottman, I think, says 5 to 1, and I've seen 20 to 1, all sorts of, whatever ratio, whatever number, the idea is, it has to be far in excess in your positive responses than your negatives. When I first saw that in parenting, it was a little bit frightening because if you pay attention to our interactions with our children, we are nowhere near that. It's often, I can say we because I'm around parents with their children often, and it's pretty horrible in terms of when you just define the interaction. That interaction, does that make the child feel good about themselves, neutral, or did it make a child feel bad about themselves? And our ratios are horrible as far as making the children feel bad. Don't do this, don't do that, don't say that, do this, don't clean that up. It's a constant barrage of corrective statements that don't leave the children feeling warm and fuzzy when it's supposed to be just the opposite. It needs to be totally weighted to the other side. That's just we'll talk about this. So within, this is how I read it, within your 80% positive comments, So this particular book, I forgot which one I was reading, said 40% of them should be in response to something the child did, like a positive comment. I love the picture you drew. It's so nice. It's, however, one needs to pray, how to praise correctly is a whole different story. But as some form of a praise of the child in response to something the child did, they should feel good about themselves. And 40 of them should be unconditional love, not in response to something that the child did. It should be, you look great today, I love you so much, giving the child a hug, not in response. So that when you think about, if you're really doing this, that 8 out of 10 are positive interactions, 4 of them are unconditional love, and 4 of them are in response, the child grows up to be healthy and perfect and well-adjusted because they're getting this lovely sense in which they don't feel they need to produce to be loved. Because if all of your positive comments are only in response to something the child has done, they only hear good things from you when they come home from school with a positive report card, a good mark in school, they cleaned up the room. If that's the only time they hear a compliment, what does the child grow up thinking? You know, mommy only loves me, daddy only loves me when I do something good. So you need to temper that with unconditional love. But if you only gave the child unconditional positive statements, and then the child doesn't really feel responsible, they need to produce anything because no matter what I do, I'm sure this is news, or I'm sure I've heard things like this, news, whatever. Out of your positive comments, half are unconditional, half are responses, and you'll have the perfect, well-developed, adjusted child, and everything will be great.
So I read that. 20%
would be unconditional. And then we could be ourselves for the other 20, and we could say, don't do that, or what were you thinking? So, yeah.
It's not the first time I've seen this number here, but you talked about 20 positives to 1. The statistics are far. I've never seen something so.
Yeah.
What appears to be unhumanly high.
Yeah. So I'm going to get through how I'm going to get that. I want to start. This is what I read a couple of years ago, and I read that, and I'm hoping that you're at least thinking of the same. Like that made a whole lot of sense. Like that's great. Like if I could produce that with my children, like I think the reason why it stuck me so hard is that I listened to myself speaking with my children. I wasn't close to 8 to 10. It was 2 to 8. The other way, in which maybe 2 things were a positive feel-good experience for the kids, and the other 8 were just barking commands. Doing this, don't do that, bad time, get in here, do this. And so I was like, this isn't the atmosphere I want in my home, so I thought it was great. And then I tried doing it. And I'm like, okay, like looking around for 4 things that I need to constantly be unconditional love, and 4 of them in which I'm responding. And I found it to be really hard. I don't want to use the word impossible, but pretty close to find those things to create those positive interactions in which I could be doing that with the kids. And we could easily just translate to a spouse. It's the same story. It wasn't natural where that made itself available and where that I was able to do that.
What are some examples of unconditional?
I love you. You look awesome. You're the best. You're the cutest. You're delicious. Just give
those
me a hug.
Those are based on parents. Based on, besides I love you, those are based on parents, and then maybe kid things will have to dress like this or.
No, I mean,
washing my face.
No, it should be without. Yeah, you're just saying out of the blue, you know, just why are you so delicious? I can't take it. You're so delicious. Just saying things like that out of the blue, just that the child should feel. That you're so I recommend this. I do this to my children all the time, and I recommend it to everybody. I constantly will say to them things like, I have one question. You have to answer this question. How did Hashem make you so cute? So, and they know, like when I grab them and hold them upside down, that's the question they're going to get. And until they say something along the lines of because I love them so much, or because they love me so much, or because I'm so delicious, it's a game, but it's ingrained in their head. They know that they're going to get a question along the lines of, why are you so delicious? Why are you so cute? Why do I love you so much? How did Hashem? It's crazy. I can't understand how it's so. It creates an atmosphere where they're used to the fact is, and we're introducing that Hashem did it to them, that I'm crazy about them, and that it becomes a game, but it's a great. You know, like it's a great thing that they should just be accustomed to as far as this atmosphere of creating those positive sentiments in which they know that they're loved just because they're delicious. Just because they're cute, just because you think they're irresistible. It's a great, but I still, yeah.
Yeah, I think
That's a great question. My oldest is 8. Yeah, my oldest is 8, and it's true already. And I was like, I do it with my 5 and 3-year-olds. You probably should say, I would guess that. I don't have an adolescent, so...
Yeah. No, I'm only saying that. Only, I mean, you have one older than we do, but I'm just saying, just from my experience as a teacher.
Or say it anyway.
If you say the opposite, will they take it as a compliment?
No, I mean, I would imagine an adolescent's self-esteem is far more fragile than my 3-year-old. So it's worth it. Like I would for say, yeah, do it in private, not in front of their friends, but they should.
Yeah,
right. So I struggled with this actually doing it. Just the numbers, it was very hard. So then I want to share with you what Gottman talks about, this concept of bidding, which totally changed my understanding of this whole concept, and I have really just found to be an unbelievable concept. Bidding is what he calls our bids for attention from our spouse. Let's just shift back from parenting for a second into marriage and our spousal relationship. We make bids when we want attention. We make bids hundreds of times a day over all sorts of things, from minor things to major things, over the course of the day in all areas of our life. We bid for attention, we ask for help, we ask for empathy, we make bids for emotional support, we make bids for affection, we make bids for play, we make bids for entertainment. We just simply communicate our needs and our wants to our spouse, just limited to the discussion to this, in tons of ways and interactions. And what it basically looks like is one spouse doing or saying anything which simply demands or requests some form of a response from the other. They could be little things. Most of the time, they're very little things. This is what makes up the course of our daily reactions. Someone's making up a shopping list and says, do we need more laundry detergent? Well, no, there's a question that's just been posed out there. There's a question in the kitchen.
What do you want to eat?
Good, excellent. Right? What do you want to eat tonight for supper? What should I make for supper? So here's a wife saying, I'd like to serve some supper. What would you like to eat? So there's been a little, this is a bid of information. It's not necessarily a bid for conversation. It's just a bid of, well, so I once spoke about this in shul. And the example that I gave then is in a game of tennis. So you stand on opposite sides of the net. Someone takes a ball and lobs it over. Now that the ball has been lobbed over, the reality is it's now in my court. I have to respond in some way to the ball that's in my court. I can either play the game and hit it back, or I can sort of ignore and let it go right by me. When I ignore that and it goes right by me, the game doesn't really last very long because one person is lobbing over the ball and the other person is not really responding in kind. In a match, in a game, even if it's whatever it is, whether it's just a volley or having a good time, by definition, once I throw the ball into your court, I need you to hit it back. I need there to be a response. So if I make a bid, let's say just for a tenth conversation, and a bid for conversation would simply look something like, how was your day today? I am putting myself out, like to have a conversation with my spouse. How did it go? And if my response is, without any follow-up, or while I'm busy reading the newspaper or returning an email. So whereas I put something out, instead of taking the opportunity to turn towards me, my spouse has basically either just ignored it or turned away. Sometimes the turning away can be pretty harsh in the rejection of whatever the request was for some form of attention. Sometimes it's just simply really ignoring. Now, just to flush out the point a little bit about what this is about, bids are not always necessarily a question. They're sometimes simply a comment. Sometimes, you know, someone is doing something, there's a groan. You ever have that? You go sitting at the table, you're working whatever you're working on, and someone lets out a groan like that. So, okay. Now you're sitting there. Now, what I'm, so Rizky does that to me. I'm sitting at the table, and I'm working on preparing this lesson, and I hear a groan like that. Now, what's that groan? So Gottman coins it. Well, she's bidding. She's put forth something of, I'm struggling with something. Something is bothering me. She's not saying, Chatz will come over here and sit down and talk about this. She's doing it, and we'll talk about why this is in a minute, but this is often just the way that we function, with this groan. Now, I can either ignore it, pretend I didn't hear it, or I can turn it towards her and say, what's going on? Those tiny little interactions take place hundreds of times in your home, where there's an opportunity to respond to someone doing or saying something, and you can either turn towards your spouse by accepting, taking it, responding to whatever it is, or you could turn away by ignoring it. While I was sitting at the table for 20 minutes last night just jotting this down, so I noted three different minor bits. Rav Gamna has two different types. This is what he calls like mindless moments. There's nothing major is going on. It's a mindless moment kind of bit going on. While I'm sitting at the dining room table, three things happened. While I'm preparing this little section on while I'm sitting there, so number one, Rivka is sitting at the same table listening to her message on the phone and says, that's hilarious. Something like, I'm sorry. So someone's at the table, my wife is commenting on the messages she's listening to, she says, that's hilarious. So there's something out there. I can either ignore that. She didn't say anything to me, she was just commenting to the right, she's talking to herself. That's funny, isn't it? Now really what she's doing, in a very subtle way, is saying, something very funny just happened and I'd like to share it with you. So I can either turn towards her and say, what's so funny?
So she can say it's nothing.
Right? And then it's the same thing. In other words, that's totally fine. In other words, she's made some, in his terminology, some bid to say, I think this is cute. I can either turn towards her and say, I want to share your life. What's so funny? And then she can do the same thing to me and say, I'm not really interested in sharing, nothing. Conversation is over. That's real sweet. Or she can say, oh, this and this just happened, at which point I say, oh, that's so cute. So Gottman writes, I told you last week how they videotape all these couples over the course of the weekend, he says, these are the moments in which he says, this is where I predict divorce. With that 90, 95, whatever rate of accuracy, it's not in these glamorous moments. It's not in these glamorous moments where these major events are taking place. We are just watching them sit and read the paper on Sunday, and we see if they're interacting. We see whether or not one spouse will say, reading the newspaper, wow! And the other one says, what? And they say, oh, I just read about this, this, and that. Says, oh, that's so interesting. And they go back and they read. He says, when you see that, there's a dialogue. There's interest in each other in which you're turning towards the spouse, as opposed to when they watch these things or you're in the car and someone's driving and someone says, wow, look at that sunset. And there's no response. No, the person who's driving doesn't look over and say, wow, that's nice. Or, I'm dizzy. There's just nothing. It's just a zero response. But what happens when we continuously make comments like that and we don't get a response? We very quickly stop making them because it doesn't really feel very good when we say things like that and there's no response on the other end. If I'm reading the news online and three times I say, wow, unbelievable, and I get zero response to my wife sitting on the couch, well, what's going to happen is I'm going to start reading the news to myself because I clearly don't have anybody who's interested in sharing it with me. Well, those small little things are turning away from each other as opposed to turning towards. In this context in which you have all families and children and life is busy, Gottman writes, in these small, minor, little interactions of the day is really the bedrock of your life together, in which there are these little bids made for all sorts of different things, for attention, for intimacy, for love, for affection, for cuddling, and we either respond to them or we turn away. So some are mindless moments, and some are much more serious things. He brings an example of husband's running out to work in the morning, and his wife comes in, so he's just about getting finished in the bathroom, getting dressed, and she says, what a horrible dream I had last night. So he doesn't have time. I don't have time. I'm late. So what do you do right now? What just took place in this small little interaction in the bathroom as he's running out, late to an appointment? Well, she obviously had something very traumatic. So she comes in and she says to her best friend, I just had a horrible dream last night. He doesn't have time to talk about it right now. So here's what he could either say, listen, I don't have time, I gotta go. And he runs out, and she's sort of left holding the bag with this horrible dream and nobody who wants to hear about it. As opposed to saying, I want to hear, or tell me quickly about it, I have to run, we'll talk about it tonight. Somehow responding to the bid that was made, I need help right now. This is not a mindless moment of, wow, I'm reading the paper and no one cares. It says, I need help, I just had something traumatic, and I'm actually I care, I want to respond, I want to be involved. I might not have the time now, but I'm going to take the time to tell you, I can't talk about it right now, I want to. Why don't you tell me in 30 seconds so we can talk about it later? And then actually remembering during the day to call during a break and finding out. That's not a dramatic moment. It really isn't. The difference between the two ways of responding is the difference between a couple that turns towards each other, develops a friendship and a love, and a basis of everything in marriage, and when it's not. And the terminology, what I love about the concept is the idea that it's once I read it, it becomes tangible. I notice all the time the things that, as I said, like last sentence, so I got one, wow, that's hilarious. I got a, in the dining room, don't forget to vote tomorrow. Simple thing, right? So I said to myself, like, this is so interesting. What if I don't respond to that? I got a very simple comment. Rifki's reading the news. Oh yeah, there's a big... she voted early. I didn't get my mail on time, so I didn't. I had to go. She said, don't forget to vote tomorrow. We can't even see each other. I'm like in the room over there. Do you know the difference in the house between a comment like that that's left hanging and one that gets a response of thanks? Didn't like take a lot. It's a different atmosphere in the home in which those sentences aren't left hanging. And I noticed when I read how often they otherwise are. This is just for the announcements here. Have you ever been walking around the house and pretended you didn't hear your wife call your name? I just didn't hear it. I'm sure wives never do that because husbands are much louder. But you sometimes, in the back, you sort of hear that, I know, I'm busy. So the thing with these bids are, we're always busy. Right? Does anyone here ever lounge around the couch, twiddling your thumb, waiting for your spouse to comment to you about the newspaper article they're reading? Right? Does that ever happen to you? Where you're sitting, like, waiting for someone to say something that you could respond to? We're always doing something. We're always doing our work, we're always busy with the kids, we're always busy with ourselves, we're always reading our own thing. So when that comment comes from our spouse, it's always going to require us to actually stop whatever it was that we were previously doing to turn towards our spouse and say, what? Tell me about it. And sometimes it's a 3-second dialogue, but the difference is enormous.
I was going to say, I'm just curious. A common thing that goes on in our house is, boy, the garbage smells bad.
Right.
So that's common.
Yes.
Now, it's gotten so common that we already understand it to be a euphemism, but is it bad for me to respond, I suspect you want the garbage to be taken out. Could you please just ask for it as opposed to anything?
So Gottman speaks about this, about the next point. So Gottman says like this. He terms it unclear bits. Now that's pretty clear,
yes, that's
but it will be. But it fits into what he describes as unclear bids. Why do we make very often unclear bids?
Looking for validation.
So he writes as follows: very often we don't want to feel. We don't want to nudge. I don't want to be like. I don't want to be a nagging spouse who is always saying, "Can you please take out the garbage?" So we try to protect ourselves. I don't like being in that position. Oh, we don't like to ask for things. We somehow deep down within us, we feel like we're all superheroes and we can really handle everything ourselves, so that when if we need to ask for something from our spouse, it's somehow a weakness or we feel guilty that we're asking for something. Yeah.
Going back to your earlier point, I'm saying this sort of sarcastically, but seriously.
Yeah.
I don't want to make a withdrawal on something like the garbage.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
So we're just fine. In other words, so let's say, add that through. Sometimes it's a matter of, I don't, like, well, I need to ask you for this. I'm asking for a favor for the garbage. Like, I don't want to ask for that favor. So we try to make it in a little bit of a hint, or we don't say straight out. So he writes also, and I think in my experience, probably more importantly, we're trying to protect ourselves. Because the last thing that we want is to be rejected. If we openly ask for something, you know, taking out the garbage is a simple example where there's no real fear of rejection. But when we want something a little bit more intimate between us as a couple, whether it's a conversation, let's take something simple as a night out. I would really like to have a night out. Let's go out for dinner one night, get a babysitter and go out. Well, the last thing that I want to hear is, not really interested. I don't want to hear that. I mean, this is a simple example, right? That's not even really personally offensive, but it still is. So I don't want to hear that. So it's much easier to save face by making that bid in a less direct request than saying, you know, we really don't go out enough. I'd really like to go out. Nah, I don't like that. I don't want to do that. Or are you going to get one of those, I don't want to go there. So what I do is I probe for interest. And the way that we probe for interest is in a much less direct request of, let's taking that example of going out for dinner. So instead of saying directly, I don't think we go out enough. I'd really like to go out for dinner. Are you available this week? So we'll say, you know, something along the lines of, you know, it's been so long, or how, whatever you would say, and taking whatever example, and each couple develops their own little code language for these kinds of things in which we make a request, and we sort of almost probe for interest without directly asking. And part of the task of this concept, which is a concept we've really lived, but the words that he's using to put it into an actual concrete idea when we make these bids is we're very often simply probing for interest in a way that we can also protect ourselves. And I have actual tapes of his, I got him doing this presentation, so I was watching it on this part. So he brought it as an example, say, you know, a husband wants to snuggle on the couch on a lazy Sunday afternoon with his wife. So, but she's busy, she's on her email, so he's not really sure, and he's got some time off. So he says, I don't want to just sort of say, like, well, why don't you take a break from your email, and we'll just hang out on the couch, and maybe grab a cup of coffee together, and just sit there for a while. Because she might say something like, I'm not really busy, he's not on time now. So you probe for interest just to see whether or not it works. Are you really busy? Would be a question that would be asked, or what kind of email, how much long, you know, you'll ask a question which is a step below your actual request, because if the answer is going to be, oh, it's crazy, I have 1,000 things to do by 6 o'clock, so then I don't even bother asking to spend time and forget it. So I save face in the way that I ask. So your garbage example is really more towards nudging or not being, you know, using up points. You want to just sort of, it's sometimes a nicer way to around the house of saying, you know, garbage smells bad, rather than actually asking you. But the idea is the dialogue is always there, in which when you get that the garbage smells bad, you could choose to ignore that, or you can say, so take it out.
Is that pet or have a topic to live with? That thing, garbage smells bad, that when you...
No, it's really not. A lot of times I'll just say lots of times that is I have a ridiculously sensitive sense of smell. So
absolutely.
And the kids are like nobody picks up. I walk into the house and there could be one thing in that garbage can and I pick up on it. And I'll say it doesn't have to be full. It smells fantastic.
Go to a much smaller trash can.
And
she's garbage. Grocery bags. You can always pick it out. Nothing wrong.
He takes them around and starts shopping garbage.
That's right.
So they're not using it.
When Caitlin was very young, she used to always come up and say, you know, Abba, that sandwich looks really, really good. And I look at her and I say, it is. You want some?
So
it took like almost half a year to get around that habit because she was always going, you know, like making all these sounds.
I'm really thirsty.
Right.
That's the most stupid.
So there's nothing like that.
Right, so that's it. So the thing is, so for me, a lot of times I'll say, you know, the garbage really stinks, as opposed to take out, you know, it's
right.
Ready to go out.
I don't think there's anything over there.
But creating that vulnerability where a person, for example, that sound smells real good. You could say, yeah, it is a thing that I it could help you like some. So if you say, again, the child may make him or herself a little more vulnerable because it's a little subtle, but if there's, again, maybe it comes from there being goodwill in a relationship and some sensitivity, but if there isn't, I mean, you know, a perfect example is, let's say, I think the radio is loud in the car. So I could say, you know, it might turn down the radio, or I could say, you know, the radio's been loud. So, if my wife says, oh, do you want me to turn it down? I'll feel much better if she says, I want me to turn it down. Because I think it's going to turn it down. It says, the lounge says, I want me to turn it down, and I feel better. So that seems to be a very positive interaction.
There's no problem with making unclear bids or making, that's totally fine. The only issue is that we learn to pick up on it. These are obvious examples. You know, the radio is too loud. I think it's a nice way of asking to turn the radio down without actually asking to do it. There's no problem with that. The garbage smells is a nice way of asking, please take out the garbage. You know, whether or not a spouse would prefer to be asked is a wonderful thing for the spouse to say, I happen to like it. I won't be offended. I would prefer if you would just say, can you please take out the garbage? That's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, like, what difference does it make? That's totally fine, as long as, but if you'll notice, and the homework assignment for the week would be, pay attention in your interactions, just amongst yourselves, how many times you want something from your spouse, and you don't say it directly. We do this very often, and the more private and intimate the setting is, the more that we want something like garbage and radio are very, like, that has nothing to do with me personally, so yeah, I'll be very clear with what I want. The more that one of the two spouses is wanting for something more personal between the two of you, whether it's time, intimacy, some form of a connection, talking about something, there we start walking on eggshells a lot more, and the requests that we make to talk about them are much more hidden and covered, and the task, he says, is learning to pick up on the way that we make those bids for whatever it is that we're making the bids for. Bringing it back to the beginning, so he writes, these create positive interactions. Anytime you respond to something that's going on in the house, you don't have to, you know, have a unconditional love statement to your spouse and say, you're so beautiful. It's great to do that. It's hard if you're keeping track, you know, 8 out of 10, and it's hard. These responding, turning towards the spouse when you have these little interactions which go on hundreds of times throughout the day are fulfillments of that concept of positive interactions. They're creating very positive interactions. And if you want to have, you know, your 20 to 1, your 5 to 1, whatever the ratio is of positive to negative, they're fulfilled in hundreds of ways as you go through your regular day, just simply doing things, but responding to whatever it is that's going on, turning towards the spouse as opposed to away. When you talk about children, children are fantastic at bidding for our attention. I mean, they can do so hundreds of times an hour, not a day. An hour, they are constantly, mommy this, mommy that, mommy this, can we do this, can we do that, can we see this? It's a constant barrage of requests for attention. We as adults are a little bit more subtle, and we take a hint a little bit better when, or we're just more socially adept at knowing when is an appropriate time or not an appropriate time, and children are not. That's part of what makes them children. But what they're doing is constantly asking and bidding for our attention. What happens to us adults when we make bids for attention and we don't get any response? We shut down. So children have that same response. It sometimes manifests itself a little bit differently. Sometimes they don't shut down and they just will ask forever because they don't know socially that they're supposed to shut down. So they just keep on asking. They will often do that. Or they also shut down. They also learn. Or what they do is they'll try something else to get our attention. And when we're inconsistent in our responding to them, the messages that they get, they put out a bid for attention. Mommy, I want something to drink. And we'll say, you know, sometimes we just ignore it. We don't respond at all. So they ask again, Mommy, I want a drink. And we're on the phones. We're not responding. I want a drink. 1 minute. Okay, when I ask them the third time, so then I get, you know, the 1 minute. And then 5 minutes go by and it's the same routine, or as the children get older, whatever it may be. But children are constantly bidding for our attention in the same way as we turn towards our spouses. We have to learn to turn towards our children, sometimes telling them, I don't have time right now, but I will in 10 minutes, or I will in a half hour, or I can't do this at all for you today. The worst things that we can do are ignore the bids. Now, I'm not saying that sometimes you have to ignore a child's thing, but if you didn't ever respond to it, when they said something and you didn't ever respond, and if you note, we pick up on other people's children much more than our own. Sometimes I will have someone else comment to me at my own Shabbos table, your son wants your attention. And he'd been sitting there for 10 minutes. You know, daddy, 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 daddy. And it's I'm not, you know, selective, not hearing it. And someone else, like, grating on their nerves, like, can you please respond to your son for me? Like, my conversation can wait. And there's a little boy there who's just, you know, constantly, and so it's fine to say, I'm in the middle of a conversation, I'll be with you in 5 minutes. That's a fine response, but there needs to be some form of a dialogue in the same way as we as adults appreciate it when we're responded to, so do the children. And if you'll note, because you go through, especially as the kids get older, they are constantly begging for our attention. And it's a dance of, we need to get our lives, things need to be done, cooker, dinner needs to be cooked, and baths needs to be given, and kids need to be read, some kids to bed, and even though the other kids still begging for our attention. But there is that same dance that goes on amongst ourselves and spouses within the day, where there's a bid for affection, attention, whatever. Children are doing the same thing, and it's so key to be tuned into that, to note what it is that they're doing, to be able to respond.
So just to get some clarity here, you're saying that your understanding of when talking about the 20 positive interactions, a positive interaction is just a response.
100%, yes. And that's how we get to such a high number, why it's so critical. And for me, it was so relieving when I saw that, because I had struggled so much with comments, you know, positive feedback. It was just hard to do. But he put a whole new perspective. It doesn't have to be, you know, glorious. It doesn't have to be some massive thing. It's sometimes as simple as, don't forget to vote tomorrow. Thanks for reminding me. It's just a different dynamic in the home when you have, I feel like there's someone else here with me, and it's such a small thing that goes on, but it has such a massive impact. And in the concept that he's trying to build of, you need to be friends, building that concept of friendship, that ability to simply turn towards as opposed to turn away, is really, really huge.
It sounds like he doesn't believe there's any neutral interaction. It's either positive or negative.
That's probably, yeah. In other words, I hit the tennis ball into your court, like, you got to respond to it. You know, if it's either left hanging, and I'm sort of left with that.
Must it out of bounds.
Right. Now there's some comments which are otherwise left out of bounds, but most of the time, yeah. In other words, and that's what I was saying. It's so hard to do because we're always doing something else, and that's why it's in these small day-to-day, daily things that you really build that relationship. Because how different is it when you know, like, when I make a comment to my spouse, I'm going to get a response. Like, that, it seems so obvious, but it doesn't always happen. It doesn't always happen that a simple comment as, you know, what do you want for dinner? A shrug. Like, well, that doesn't help me. Like, you could tell me, what are my choices? What are you in the mood for making? What do you have in the house? Something. But when I ask you, what would you like for dinner? Acknowledge that I asked you something, and there's something going on there. And again, more importantly, are the bigger things when they're actually these bids for more important, significant conversations. You know, the groans, or your mother-in-law's driving me crazy. Whatever, you know, or my mother-in-law, your mother, whatever it may be. Those are the things that to note the opening, what's going on, and respond to that. Your cards, which I'm not going to do now so that we can move on, but I think it's the yellow cards.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Something that I want to learn from is that I do respond, but have no recollection at all of what I responded. If it was positive, I mean, I'm sure it was a negative, but I have no idea what I said. And then I found out what you said, and I'm like, I have no idea. You were asked that question.
Have you had a baby within the last 2 years?
Exactly.
Right. In other words, the man. No, it's better. In other words, the truth is that when we respond and we really care, we remember more than when it was just a nothing. Now, probably most of the times were what he would call these mindless moments of, you know, it might not have been such an important thing to you or to him. So yeah, I responded at the time, but it didn't really register because it wasn't something of major importance. So, you know, it's trying to pick up on the ones that are more important and to pay more attention. That's always, like, when I hear somebody's name, the reason why I can't remember 30 seconds later is because I really didn't pay attention. And if someone were observing me, they would say, sure, I had a conversation with the person, and I asked him what his name was, and he responded, and I said, where are you from? And the fact that I can't remember 10 minutes later is because I wasn't really there. So there's always what to grow as far as being more present to the conversation than we are. Is it? Yeah. So these are the yellow cards, expressing needs cards. So these, the way they set up these cards, and again, I'm not going to do this right now. What he wants you to do with these are that many of these cards are part of these things that I first of all don't like the word needs. I would go with the word wants for most of these, but that's just a linguistic kind of thing. Things that we want out of our spouse, and we often have trouble directly addressing. So the purpose of these cards are, if we were to do this activity now, would be to go through them and you pick out one or two that speak to you, and then you bring that up. You would each take turns saying, you know, I have the first one that's up here is, I need you to be on my side. So this would be relevant if I'm having trouble with my parents and my wife is always taking my mother's side. I need you to be on my side on this one. That's the kind of thing that I might have trouble actually expressing, but I'm having a lot of trouble with this relationship, and I need support. I need you to be with me on this, and then it just creates an ability. It creates a dialogue in the same way as the love map cards just allows you to create a dialogue. These allow you to create. I need some time alone for myself. This is a great one. Many people feel that, especially the introverts amongst us. Just need some time to myself. Well, if my spouse doesn't know that about me, so as I'm retreating farther and farther into my shell, she's making more and more of an interest to bring me out. Because that's what an extrovert wants to do. But I really just need some time to myself. So the way that I will almost express that might not come out right. But that's part of this dance of being able to say, this is what I need right now. And being able to do that in a positive manner. So the way that these cards work, and I encourage you to do them on your own, go through them. Most, I would imagine, you know, 70% of them might not be relevant to you, but the ones that are good. You can have a lot of fun making fun of the couple sitting next to you with with them.
You can pick a few. You can play. Like, keep one on you.
And everyone can guess which card Dan showed to the stroll. And these are yours. Okay. Let me move on to next part. So far, so good. Anyone need a break, drink, cookies, something, whatever. Okay. The whole concept, this whole workshop that Gottman created. The card should. I just want to stress to the people who are getting a kick out of them. They should be funny, a lot of them, and you should have a good time with them because that's part of the, you know. It's a funny thing when you see some of them because either they apply to you so much that it's hilarious or they don't apply to you so much that it's hilarious. But either way, it's a good thing to go through them. I highly recommend them. You'll have a good time, both here, both at home. Enjoy. Okay. The premise of this workshop that Gottman creates is based on two things. One of them we've been dealing with for the first half, and that is the concept of friendship. And the... Maybe you just want to spend some time doing them. Are you guys having too much of a good time? I don't mind. I'm going to pick out the ones that your spouse you think needs. Take those out of the list.
Hi, Dave. Send some of those cards before you.
So part of the first half of the workshop that he developed is about developing friendship. It's about the ability to do things, to learn the skills that are required to further and constantly develop that. Whether or not that's working on the love map cards, just getting to constantly update each other on that which is going on in your words, whether or not getting better at the fondness and admiration, being able to compliment, stress the compliments, write the little mitzvah notes out, create that environment of a positive environment in the house, whether or not it's through this idea of turning towards each other. And I hope that as you go through this next week, you will just note how many times those things go on in your home, where there are things that are said, and there's either a response, an opportunity to, and how that can create that. The other half of the workshop is based on what he calls managing conflict. Yeah. Now, managing, he uses those words very carefully, managing conflict.
Not resolving.
Correct. Exactly. As opposed to resolving conflict, or as opposed to avoiding conflict. Why would you say, is it more important to manage conflict than to resolve or avoid conflict? That is correct. Because of the fact that each one of you are two separate human beings, each one of you grew up in different homes, different environments, are a different set of personality and traits, it is impossible to take two human beings, to put them into a home together, and there not be conflict. It can't be that way. Unless you married yourself, there would, and even that probably wouldn't. Someone tell me recently about, there was a Seinfeld about that? Who was just telling me that? I don't remember who it was. Yeah, so this is about, he finally found a girl who was just like him, and it was crazy, they got engaged, and like 2 weeks later, they broke it off. He says, I hate her, I hate myself, this is ridiculous. There's an old episode about that. In any case, but the reality is you're all different. You all have different needs, different wants, different personality traits, and that's going to create conflict. The thought process that we are not going to fight, we are not going to disagree on important things, is ridiculous. Most people probably go into the marriage thinking that, at least on the big things, for sure not. Maybe they do, they don't. It's absurd. All of you know, having been married, that's ridiculous. You'll all have good days and bad days, and during your bad days, you'll for sure fight, and during your good days, you'll have major disagreements, especially once you start having children and how to raise the children. There's no way you agree to spoke about every single thing. So avoiding the fighting is impossible, yeah.
Is there like a target range? I mean, is there like a number of times you're fighting where it's like,
we'll talk all about that. He writes, so avoiding it is impossible. The question is managing it. The question is, how do you fight? When he watches all these videos, he's never looking to see if they fight, because he actually gives them, when he videotapes the couples in his lab for the weekend, he actually over the course of the weekend gives them opportunities and says, I want you to discuss your most recent fight. Like, talk about it. See where you're at. So he wants them almost to fight, and that's part of married life, is disagreements and conflict that's going to be there. The question is how you fight. How does it work? How do you manage those conflicts? The language that's used, the attitude that's used. All of those issues are really where it's at during the conflict and after that determine that he would say, I look at to figure out where is this couple holding that? Do they fight? How do you fight? How do you manage that? See, he writes also that, in response to your question, Dan, that whether or not some couples avoid it at all costs, they'll try to avoid it. Other couples will hash it out. You know, if they have a disagreement, let's talk it, let's go through it. Others will talk it out peacefully. Whatever method you use is fine, as long as both parties are fine with that particular method. If one wants to avoid it and one wants to always talk about it, that's not going to work. If one wants to fight it out, get it out of our system, put it on the table, and the other one just, you know, doesn't want to, then that won't work. So the only number is working that out. That's going to be the second half. We'll do it for the rest of today, and then for next week is this idea, this concept of managing conflict. I saw in one of the books, this story, we'll just start with this. There was, some old master of some wisdom, religion, whatever it was, that never got married. So one of his students had questioned him about it. His younger student said, master, how come you never got married? So he said, well, I was looking for the perfect girl. So the student says, I guess you never found her. He says, no, that's not true, actually, I did find her. What's the problem? How come you didn't marry her? She was looking for the perfect guy. Cute and very telling. You know, so that's the way that it is. None of us are perfect. We all have our issues, and it's going to be there. It's going to be part of our relationship. The question is how we manage it. So to start this part, I would use the following two phrases, and this was the biggest relief to me when when I went through this myself. It's just great because, you know, we're all in the same boat. That's the bottom line. Solvable and unsolvable problems. Very often, we get caught up having the same disputes, the same conflict, the same issue, over and over and over and over again. He writes in their study, they followed couples for 15 years. That's part of he's a researcher, as I mentioned, Gottman. So a lot of his books are based on actual research. So they've had the same couples they've been following for literally years. And he writes, for a good chunk of that, or 70% of the conflicts that they've had, of the couples that they trace, you know, the styles change, the clothing changes, the hairstyles change, and the issues are the same every single year when they come in and they spend the weekend in the lab and they record everything. They're still talking about the same things. And the reason for that is, we are who we are. Let's just take the simple example of the extrovert-introvert, as we discussed last week. If I'm an introvert, you can't make me an extrovert. You can't. That's who I am. Part of my makeup is this is what I am like. These are the things I like to do. I like to be by myself sometimes. You can't change that. You can't ask me to change that. You can't. That's the way that it is. Well, if I'm married to an extrovert, we will dispute what we should do on Saturday night, every single Saturday night of our married lives together. Every once in a while, I'll be a little bit more awake and I'll have no problem going out. And every once in a while, my life might be a little more timely, happy staying home. That issue is going to be there all the time because that's who we are. So many of our issues are like that and they're just unsolvable. When you have an unsolvable problem and you try to resolve it, you're never going to get anywhere because it can't be resolved. So we'll do one little activity. This one is straight out of their book on the marriage book. Do you have a piece of paper and a pen? Grab a piece of paper and a pen. In this book? Oh, this is not in this book. It's not in this thing. You could use a piece of paper from there if you want. Oh, that's yours. All right, so this is straight out of Gottman's book, And Baby Makes Three. He has a little Your Perpetual Issues inventory. So I'm going to read through 10. I just chose out 10. He has, 15 or 20 of them. I just want to choose in 10. You could just write down one word for each one of the issue. Like, for example, the first one is differences in neatness and organization. Just write down, neatness and organization. Then you put a check whether or not you think that you and your spouse have inherent differences in that particular issue.
Are they
not in your book? No, this one's not in your book. I looked at it. So number one, differences in neatness and organization. One of you is neat and organized, and the other is sloppy and disorganized. Perpetual issues. Or unsolvable. This is in this book. It's on page 127 of The Baby Makes Three. Perpetual issue number one, differences in neatness and organization. You can put a little check by that whether or not you feel, there's no correct answer, you and your spouse might actually disagree on this, but whether or not you feel there's a difference between you, one being perpetually neat and one being perpetually less neat. Now, these things often come not just from our personalities, they often come from the way that we were raised, the families that we came from, and we just are starting from. Very often what you'll find is that you actually will both feel that you're neat, except that one spouse came from a level where the definition of neat is on a scale of, 0 to 100 is a 70. That's considered neat, and anything less than that is sloppy. And the other one came from a home where if you were a 50, that's already neat. So they, who have rejected their parents' ways and hold themselves to be a 60, but for their spouse, who grew up in this pristine, immaculate home, their 60 is sloppy. So they might both actually think they're neat, but they're just, it's not working out. That's number one. Difference is number two, in emotionality. One of you is very emotionally expressive, and the other is not so expressive. One of you also values exploring one's emotion more than the other. would you say that does or does not apply to you and your spouse? One of you values exploring one's emotions more than the other. No cheating, Dan. No cheating.
Exploring means discussing?
Yeah, I'm wanting to talk about it. Number three, differences in approaching finances. One of you is much more financially conservative and a worrier, while the other wants to spend a lot more than the other and has a philosophy more of living for the moment. There can be variations of that. Out of the general, you know, umbrella is differences in finances. It's an approach. It's a life approach. It's the way that you were brought up, the way that you feel. Do you or do you not feel there are significant differences between you in that area of life? Number four, differences in how to approach household chores. For example, one of you, the wife, wants equal division of labor, while the other does not. They don't have the wife in there, that's just my assumption. Or in any way that you would, you know, is there a significant difference as to what's considered normal? This is a huge thing from the home that you came from, more than almost anything else. What's considered normal is, well, what did you grow up with? What did you see around your house? No, this is the same. I'm saying as far as household chores, is when a husband who grew up in a home where his father did almost nothing will feel like he's being imposed upon, like, well, what do you mean I should?
So the question is really dividing yourself.
No, so, yeah, or just do you both feel it's appropriate that we should divide and conquer? Or does one feel, no, you should divide and conquer, the other one feels, no, my job is to work outside the home and your job is to work inside the home. If you're coming from that perspective, then everything is going to be a clash.
And then role definition?
It could be, yeah, based on role definition, all of that. What do we have for number six?
Five.
Differences in how to raise and discipline children. One of you is stricter with the children than the other. And you have, would you say that does or does not apply, that you have very different approaches to raising and disciplining your children? Six. Or seven, I've lost count.
Six.
Differences in wanting time together versus wanting time apart and alone. One of you wants more time alone than the other one, who wants more time together. Which might be, you know, autonomy versus interdependence, whatever, but you have different approaches as to where, what you feel, that's, you know, that you both value time alone differently. All right, this would be, you know, like one spouse might often feel like time alone means that we're angry at each other. I don't value that. I don't think it's good, or then it was totally normal. Differences in punctuality. One of you is habitually late. But to the other one, it is important to be on time. Who's laughing here? Who's laughing? Number eight, differences in preferred activity level. One of you prefers active physical recreation, while the other is more passive and sedentary. Thank you. Say it in there.
Activity level.
Notice if you have a Sunday afternoon off, how would you prefer to spend it as a family? You know, being much more active, outdoorsy, running around, or more passive? Or even about family, just the two of you together. Number nine, differences in being people-oriented. This is very much like extrovert-introverts. One of you is more extroverted and gregarious than the other one. And number ten, this is what they have, and I wasn't sure. I was looking to quantify it a little bit better. Differences in values. You know, the major differences in what we value in life. I'll leave it open whether or not. I wasn't sure if that was a good one because it was so vague.
Does she give the definition about
that? He doesn't. You know, there are major differences in what we value in life. I don't know. Well, we can leave it without that one. Right, we probably but that's why it's just a matter of spending the time to find the areas where it would be very different, even within a couple who are pretty much aligned religiously. I think there's still a lot of room that you'll find in your marriages where you have very different values. You know, if we wanted to limit it, values as to you know, how much time we should spend with our parents or grandma, is that a value that we both share? Whatever values we have in terms of, you know, how much time should we spend? I got a question today from somebody about, you know, should I go to davening with a minyan? Because my spouse, I need more time at home, I need more time at the learning. There are lots of things that there could be values, exercise, you know. But it's a vague question. Well, you can if you want to. Alright, so my question is as follows. As you go through, what did I, if we leave the last one out, we still have nine things. And how many of those things would you say that you and your spouse have major differences on out of those nine? Okay, I mean, curious, you spend more time on this if you like. Just curious, quickly running around the room, out of this, out of the, let's call it the nine things that we had, how many would you say did we were there a significant difference on out of the nine?
Four.
Three.
One and a half.
One and a half. Wow, that's great. You guys aren't married long enough. This is great. Be yourselves. Yeah.
Oh, six.
Six. Jen, if you had to guess.
Four.
11.
Right. 2.5. So Gavin is supposed to say, so out of the room, I say we averaged probably about four, just quickly working through the room. Now, those four issues, four, five, six, whatever the number was, those are going to come up over and over and over again for the next 40, 50, 60 years. That's just the way that it is. There's only so much that you can adjust on a personality type. Most of these things are personality. The tenants are just asking me about, like, what about sloppiness and neatness? Like, that can be worked on. And it can, to an extent. There's specific tasks that a sloppy person can be trained not to leave their dirty clothes on the floor, you know, when they're leaving them. You could be trained a specific behavior, but to be a neater person, as we like to define that, like, you know, people are who they are. That's just... there's only so much you can move. So says God that you need to first learn, in the first step when we talk about managing conflict, learn to recognize which conflicts are, is there room to really move with, which conflicts is there place to talk, have this conversation and work, and which ones are, these are the way that it's going to be. This is who I married. If I marry person A, I'm going to have issues A, B, and C. Had I married person B, I might not have had those three issues. I would have had these three issues. And if I married person C, I would have had those three issues. The issues are going to be there regardless. It's just a matter of these are the ones that you chose. This is who the person is. Now I have these issues. I like it this way. She likes it that way. Recognize that and learn to deal with it. The example that he gives is if a person has, Chmana Latzlan, some form of an illness. Or it's not a serious illness, it's just a recurring lower back pain, which is pretty crippling. So you need to learn to make adjustments, right? There's no two ways about it. If you have a consistent, chronic lower back pain, you need to change your life in a way that allows you to continue on despite the fact that you're now not functioning to your full optimum level and you have this inconvenience pain and I gotta deal with it. So our spouses have personality traits which we might feel about them that it is like that. It's always there and I can't do things the way that I want to. That's totally fine. That's what life is about. Marriage is about learning to make those adjustments, to give of ourselves in ways that we wouldn't otherwise, to give up certain things that we would have otherwise have wanted. And on those issues which are really unsolvable, they're not going anywhere. They're going to be here for the next 20, 30, 40 years. How do we make adjustments to the fact that we have very different approaches to finances? I can't convince you to think like me if you don't. If you think this way about our finances, and I think this way, that's the way it's going to be. I can't convince you otherwise. I know now it's a lot of politics going on. Have you ever thought about trying to convince a liberal to be a conservative? It's like an absurd thought. That's who they. That's how they think. They think liberal. You can't convince that person that you're right. I mean, that's why we have these great debates, and you can fight for it tomorrow. But you can't change a person. That's how they think. That's what they are. That's what they enjoy doing. That's who they are. That's the way that it's going to be. So the first step in managing conflict is recognizing those things and learning to make those adjustments. And each, there's a give and a take. And that's how it has to be. That's the introduction. Let me just take the last 10 minutes and start some of the actual, you know, once you get into a dispute. So he has a whole bunch of concepts that I want to share and go through, as far as it'll help, just like the idea of bids will help you concretize that which is going on in your home, and you could identify something and respond to it because you've identified it. He has a number of terms and concepts which you've all lived through, but just it's worth mentioning. So the number first thing that I just want to go through is what he calls a harsh startup. Harsh startup is exactly as it sounds, that when there is an issue which needs to be discussed, and the spouse who has the issue with the other and wants to bring it up, brings it up in a way in which you go from 0 to 60 in like 2.5 seconds. You haven't even started the conversation, and it's bam, you're right in the heat of it. And the party who is being confronted is always taken aback, and is always thrust against the wall, and will always get defensive. Correct. Those conversations will go nowhere. See, he writes, again, he's a researcher, so everything is mapped out and studied. He writes, 96% of conversations, you can determine the conclusion based on the first 3 minutes. Just listen to 3 minutes, see how it starts. You know whether or not there's a prayer for this to be. Now, these are talking about resolvable kinds of issues. There's an issue I'd like to bring up, we need to discuss. How it's brought up in the first minute, 3 minutes, will tell. It's not even worth having the rest of this conversation because it's not going anywhere. Now, again, these are like obvious things, but it's worth just sort of going through. When you break down the issue, there are a lot of things. Number one is the concept of the pace in which the conversation gets started. And I was, you know, just thinking this through, and you find in the Chumash, you find so many ideas where this lesson is taught to us in a number of important places. Right in the very beginning, the very first sin committed by mankind is Adam HaRishon and Chava eating from the food that they're not supposed to do. What does the Torah say as soon as, how does Hashem approach them after this crime was committed? So there are two steps in the process. If you look in the Chumash, number one it says, and the sounds of Hashem were heard in the garden. Adam and Chava heard and they went to hide. So the Mefarshim explained, when someone's done something embarrassing, humiliating, and you know that you were just caught, don't catch them in their humiliation. Don't aha them right away, because that's the worst feeling. We know we've done things wrong. We're going to make mistakes. We all know that. So give them the warning so that they can, in their case, they hid. Now, obviously, it didn't last very long, but it was a breaking in of the situation of, you hear me? I'm coming. We're going to be having a conversation. How does he start the conversation? Ayeka, where are you? Rashi says, to engage him in conversation. Adam knows what's coming. That first line of, where are you, is the introduction to what's coming. There are three other places in Tanakh where Hashem does it. He does it by Bilam. When he says, who are those people that are with you, Bilam? He knows what Bilam is up to and where he wants to go. And to engage him in the conversation, he says, you know, we're with Cain. What does Hashem say to Cain? So, well, where's your brother Hevel? He doesn't say, why'd you kill him? He says, where is he? Rashi there also says to engage him in conversation. You can't start the conversation with an attack. You can't start with the claim because we don't function well that way. There has to be a progression of information that's being given so that I know there's a conversation that's about to happen, and then I get myself mentally prepared. In our mind, we work well that way. We're getting ready for it. Even when we make major requests, even if it's not going to be because I've found you doing something wrong, I have something to ask of you. How does Hashem ask Abraham about the Akedah? He says, I want you to take your son. I have two sons. Take the son that your only son. They're both only sons of the mother. Take the son that you love. I love them both. Take Yitzchak. Rashi says, because if he right away said, I want you to take Yitzchak, he would get all tumished, the tumult. And then if he did it, people would say he did it because he wasn't able to think straight. So when Hashem has a major request to ask of Avram, it's going to be slowly, I'm going to break you in because we can't think straight otherwise. We don't. Avram Avinu would not have been able to, that's the language Rashi uses, his das, his knowledge, he would have been all discombobulated, he would not have been able to think straight, and he might have done something without thinking. So he breaks him in. Avram realizes pretty quickly probably where this is going. But this, anyone who's been dealing with any trauma or when you have bad news to tell somebody about a death, Rachmana Litzlan, everybody, that's how you, right? You have to start, you have to let the person know, they have to prepare themselves. So Chazal say, how did Sarah die? Because the Malach came over and said, your son Yitzchak was taken to be killed, he didn't even get to finish his sentence, and Chazal say she died. So there's this harsh startup of, you can't jump right in to the information that you need. Same is true also with the tone. We start with this tone. I remember I once spoke about, anyone here read Blink? Malcolm Gladwell's Blink? Blink. It's called, Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called Blink. So he speaks, a wonderful book, if anyone has read it. So he speaks there also, I once mentioned this at a lunch somewhere, about a study that was done where some psychologists were studying which doctors are sued less than others. Why are some doctors sued multiple times and others are not sued at all? And they found that it wasn't they were making less mistakes. The mistake ratio was the same across the board. What they found is the difference in the way that the doctors treated their patients. There was an average of 3 extra minutes, I think it was, that the doctors who were not sued would spend with their patients. They would ask more questions. They would provide opportunities. But there was a way that they spoke. Part of then what they did with the study is, after they had the doctors divided into categories, which ones were not sued and which ones were, they took the tapes of their conversations with their patients, and they, I think it's called content filtering, where they took out all the consonant sounds so that you couldn't actually make out the words, you could just hear the tone of the conversation, and they would listen to it for a minute, and they would be able to tell from which category of doctor it was. Was this one of the doctors who was in the category of those who were sued multiple times, or was this from a doctor who was never sued? Just from the way that the doctor spoke, they could say, oh, this is a doctor, people like listening to him. He's not speaking with a haughty or aggressive or with any attitude, just from the tone, without making out the words. So we pick up on that naturally. Someone starts talking to us, and within seconds, we have already figured out, we like where this is going, or we don't like where this is going. And if we don't like where it's going, it's just blank, we just tone out. I'm not listening to this because I don't like the way that you're speaking to me. Yes, okay. Don't like the way you're talking to me. When we don't like the way that we're being spoken to, we don't listen. So when we start a conversation, even if we're doing it slowly, but if the tone that's there is already one of an attacking tone, a condescending tone, one of contempt, disgust, or any of those other lovely adjectives, it's not going anywhere because the other person's not even listening. That is this first concept, so I want to make sure we stop on time. Harsh start. We talk about a bunch of other things, but that's just the first thing. Number one, so as far as managing conflict goes, recognizing which conflicts are solvable versus unsolvable. The things on your list which you just have different impressions they're going to be that way. And when an issue needs to be brought up from your solvable issues, things happen. We need to talk about things all the time with our spouses. Things that people did wrong. One of us said something wrong, did something wrong. I don't like the way that we're raising the children. I don't like the way that you handle this situation. Whatever it may be, which needs to be addressed. The first issue that needs to be forefront in our mind, and it's an obvious thing, but always needs to be stressed and paid attention to, is how it's brought up. The tone, the way we start the attack. If it starts off bad, so he writes explicitly, just stop it right there, say, wait, that's not, can we start this again in 5 minutes? And just do that. Take a break, start it again. Because once it starts that way, it will not be successful.
Have you ever told somebody who's in that anger moment, I don't like your tone, come back in 10 minutes, that's going to make them feel much better.
It won't, but that's why it's helpful while you're not angry at each other to hear the concepts of the terms, because in other words, if you would now say that to each other, at least you now have in your vocabulary the idea that says, you know, when you start like that, I know that you're angry, I can't listen. It's not going to go anywhere. I want to say one more thing. I was once at a table with a group of people, and the wife had gotten up and went somewhere, and the conversation turned to the way that they were putting their kids to bed. And the husband was really upset about the way that he was really upset at his wife at the way that it was going. He thought they should be doing it this way, and she was doing it that way, and it was a disaster. The kids were up all night, and he couldn't tolerate it. And so I was with my wife and with another couple, and so the five of us were having this whole conversation about he needed to do this and this and this and that. His wife comes back about 10 minutes later. He's now been riled up for 10 minutes about what's going on. She sits down, and he just, like, as if she had been part of it, just like launches into the way that it has been, the way that it, like, she was like, oh, where did I, who's, like, where did it come from? So I watched, like, that wasn't gonna, like, she was not gonna change any of them. Like, it was a lost cause the second it started. So when I saw that, it occurred to me, we so often do that with our own heads. When we have an issue we want to talk about, we're angry about something, we hash it over in our heads and rehash it over 1,000 times. By the time our wife, spouse, husband walks in the door, we've had the conversation 30 times already. We're in the middle of it. And we almost, like, jump right in as if our spouse has been there with us in our heads, having this conversation, ready for us with all the arguments. But they're like being like we're, hi, it's nice to see you. But we've already had the conversation in our head 40 times. So this idea of that harsh startup is a reminder that you need to engage me also in this conversation that you've had in your head. I'm not there with you. I haven't made those arguments. You made those arguments about me for me in my defense. I actually have a different set of arguments, defenses, or whatever it may be. And the way that it starts is going to affect everything. Okay, that's the start of this second phase of the managing conflict. We'll talk much more about it, Mirza Shem, in 2 weeks.